Welcome to Eat, Drink, Think. I'm Amy O'Neill Houck. In this podcast from Edible Communities, a network of magazines published across North America, we celebrate all things local and sustainable in the food world. Today, we're speaking with Andy Murphy. Andy is the creator, host, and producer of the Toasted Sister podcast, an award-winning show that documents the Native American food movement. Andy is Dene and grew up on the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. She's the senior producer of the Native America Calling radio program, a one-hour national radio show about Indigenous issues and topics, where she produces and hosts a food-focused show every month called The Menu. In 2023, Andy was awarded a Native American 40 Under 40 prize by the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development. Also in 2023, Native America Calling was awarded a National Humanities Medal by the U.S. National Endowment for the Humanities. Andy has a journalism degree, and she's also a photographer, a home cook, and an artist who creates all the art for the Toasted Sister podcast. She lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I met Andy this past fall in Santa Fe when she was the moderator of a panel on Indigenous foodways at Edible Communities Edible Institute, an event that's open to the public and brings together speakers for talks and discussions on the most pressing and fascinating food topics. Andy, welcome to Eat, Drink, Think.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. So your panel at Edible Institute was about the future of Indigenous food, and I know we'll be talking about that in a little bit, but I wanted to step back and just ask you how you developed your interest in food in general and in Indigenous food in particular. Did this deep dive precede your career in journalism?
No, it actually came about when I was very new in the newsroom at the Las Cruces Sun News in Las Cruces, New Mexico. That was my first job. And right away, I got to take over the food section of the entertainment magazine that we put out every Thursday. And it just so happened to fall into my lap because I could do photography at the same time. And the editors noticed that I do really good food photography. So that section became mine, and it became an obsession after that. Like, I really needed to learn everything I could about food, about flavor, and then eventually the people and the culture and the history and all of the issues that come along with food and putting food out in a restaurant setting. So, you know, I developed that interest in food and that knowledge and specialty there while I was at the Sun News in Las Cruces. And I took that with me to my job here at Native America Calling. And this is where I also had like that crash course again in Indigenous food. So back in 2014 is when I really started that obsession mode again, but with Indigenous food. And because of, you know, what I do here as a producer, I was able to connect with Native chefs and people who were working, you know, at the beginning of this food movement around that time. And I just really started following them and learning, you know, keeping tabs on them, learning about what kind of work they finish, what kind of new work they're getting into. And from there, I just really started learning so much about all the work being done. And it was a really good time to be getting into Indigenous food, because this is when things really started popping off in Native America in terms of food. And now we see it today where we have James Beard Award winners. We have Native chefs who are making a name for themselves in the media and becoming known for, you know, putting out some really good Indigenous food. So it's been a really cool ride, and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, really.
Definitely good timing, and maybe also, you know, just a testament to your perfect skill set and your passion for the topic. So you started Toasted Sister in 2017, is that right?
Yeah.
And you've been winning awards and providing important documentation of the Native American food movement. Can you give us a little background on the podcast and tell us what you like most about it?
Yeah. So I, like you said, started in 2017, and it really started out as like a just putting the spotlight on one Native chef or one person who is working in Native food sovereignty. And, you know, I've had dozens of people on the show, and I've been meaning to go back and do like a, where are they now? You know, a couple of episodes, because, you know, back in 2017, those early days of the podcast, like those guests on the show, they are completely different. They're all grown up and they have their own businesses and they've, you know, gotten to where they wanted to go. And it's been really cool to see that process, that growth there among all of these people who are working within Native food sovereignty. So I think that is my favorite part about producing this show, is just watching all of this really good movement happening in the scene and really, you know, making connections with so many people who have a passion just like mine. They want to change the narrative, and they put a lot of work and a lot of selfless work into what they do. And it's all because of food. And that is exactly what I do. So, you know, when you're in a room with people who have the same goals and the same, you know, passion for something, nothing can come of it except a good time and a good conversation and just really good motivation and energy. So that's what I also like about doing this podcast.
It's great to have something that you find so joyful. So you mentioned food sovereignty, and those who've listened to my podcast for a while have heard us talk about that before, but can I hear your definition of food sovereignty, and particularly Native American food sovereignty, so that we're all on the same page?
Yeah, well, over the years, hearing that definition so many times too, and also just being a Native journalist who is also, you know, covering health and agriculture and the courts, you know, Supreme Court stuff and water rights, you know, I cover all of that too. So, and I've identified like four different kinds of, you know, food sovereignty. And one, you know, branch of food sovereignty would be, you know, kind of at that federal tribal level for tribes to do the work and put their own resources into creating access to food, to putting more resources and support in there for Native food entrepreneurs. And then there's another level where we have groups like nonprofits that exist just to address policy that comes with you know, food access and tribal food sovereignty, to spread education and awareness of indigenous food, to teach others about cooking and, you know, preparing and creating access in their own communities around indigenous food. And then there are, you know, sort of like grassroots groups that are doing a lot of really good work too. They've, you know, do a lot just in their own communities. They use all kinds of different resources, but usually it's a lot of sharing that happens within their, I guess, mission and purpose. And then the most important branch of food sovereignty I've identified is that personal food sovereignty, the ability to feed yourself. And that includes a whole lot more than just having access to food. It's having access to traditional foods and healthy foods and different foods, and knowing how to cook it, knowing how to process it, and having a developed palate where you're able to bring anything, even if it's new or traditional and you've never had it before, those kinds of lessons and that kind of knowledge for the individual is so, so very important, because all of the work that chefs and farmers and policymakers and tribal leaders and community leaders and all of these people who are working for food sovereignty, all of that work means nothing if we can't bring all of this into our own kitchens and be hungry for it and be creative with these ingredients and flavors. So yeah, that's my long definition of food sovereignty.
I think it's fabulous. So what I hear you saying is that it's empowerment and it's access, but it's a very nuanced type of sovereignty that falls from anywhere from lawmaking to organizing to then the very rich personal ability to get and use the foods that you want as a Native person. I love that definition.
Yeah, we can even branch into like protecting resources too. Water and land and protecting wild areas. That also goes into a lot of the work that's happening in different sectors of Indian country and, you know, all boils down to preserving food.
And of course, it's varied, right? You know, the Native people in your area might have very different needs and stewardship and access and foods that they're trying to protect and get, as opposed to people, you know, in my part of the country. So that makes it all the more interesting to look at and talk about. Yeah. What are some of the episodes that you have coming up on Toasted Sister?
Oh my gosh, I have like four just sitting in my laptop. If you ask me what's my least favorite thing about this podcast, it's the editing, the audio editing. Like, I've just completely burned out on it. And yeah, I have an episode, which I think is going to be a two-parter. I went to California where my mom was born and raised. I went back with her to Los Angeles and we visited the same streets where she used to sit on the sidewalk with her twin sister and eat tacos. And that was like one of her first and favorite memories of growing up in Los Angeles is, you know, eating street tacos on the street. So we went back and we explored that diaspora there, the taco diaspora in downtown Los Angeles. And we also talked a lot about the relocation program that happened back then. That's the reason why she was born and raised in Los Angeles, even though she's Navajo and her parents were originally from New Mexico. So we explored that too, and how that had an impact on food sovereignty and knowledge. So that is just sitting there gathering dust in my laptop. I also talked with a local chef here, Ryan Taylor, a couple months ago. That one's coming out. He now just opened up a restaurant here in Albuquerque, so I'm going to have to add that bit into the episode. And then I talked with another local girl here. She sharpened my knives. And we talked all about sharp knives and knife stories, because she offered her knife sharpening services for the first time to the public a couple months ago. And from there, she's just been, her favorite part about doing that is listening to people talk about their knives and where they got it and who they got it from. And I cut myself doing this dinner, but it was awesome. And my grandma, you know, this and that. It was such a really cool episode. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like it could be a whole book.
Right? Knife stories.
So I feel lucky enough to live in a listening area in Alaska where Native America Calling is on our local public radio station. Shout out to KCHU out of Valdez. So tell us a bit about your monthly show, The Menu.
Yeah, The Menu. I try to do it every last of the month. And this one is it's a variety type show, but I gather about three or four news items food, Native food news items of the month or just recently. And then I gather a couple of guests who can talk about it. And we all gather around on the show and talk about new restaurants, or maybe there's like something happening with appropriation. The farm bill is gaining momentum coming up in next week. I'm going to be talking with some folks about the USDA's 2022 census of agriculture and some Native folks, the Indigenous Agriculture and Food Initiative, Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative. They are really excited about some highlights from Native agriculture mentioned in this new census. So we're going to talk about that. And I'm going to try to get my friend on to talk about his new restaurant that opened up. But it seemed like last year, every other menu had a Native chef who opened up a restaurant and a chef who published a cookbook. So last year was like the year of Native cookbooks and Native restaurants. So we talk about all these news highlights and cool stories during my show called The Menu.
That's cool. I'm gonna ask you about cookbooks in a second. But one of the reasons I really like listening to Native American Calling is the call-in aspect. It makes things really spontaneous and intimate. Can you tell me what it's like for you to do a call-in show and how that feels different from Toasted Sister?
Well, for every episode, a lot happens. A lot happens for every episode. I mean, there's research, there's gathering the right kinds of guests, and sometimes it's on topics where people don't really want to talk about it. Maybe it's like a controversial topic, and it's always hard to get this side or the other side of the topic on the show. So it's like wrangling cats. Herding cats with a water bottle sometimes. Other times it's really cool to hear people's stories before they come on the show. But it keeps me on my toes. I mean, producing the show, there's always, it's very dependent on the person. And I don't know, we keep coming to our editorial meetings and saying, we got to start doing this with our guests, or we have to tell them this, and we have to prepare them to do this and that, and better questions and stuff like that. But, sometimes that'll work and sometimes it doesn't. And it's really just like figuring people out and guessing, what it's going to sound like. But, most times we're happy with the show. Sometimes we're just like, ugh. Okay, I hope it just goes right. But the live aspect, I love it and I hate it, because there are some callers who call in and they have a comment that is on point. They have a question that is on point. But sometimes they call in and they're just way out in the weeds somewhere. Sometimes they just want to mention like, oh, you have a Navajo person on your show. I knew a Navajo person like back in the 70s. And I'm like, we're talking about, woodworking today. We're not going to take your comment.
It sounds like you've also really trained your listeners, though. I mean, people, this is a call-in show. They're used to, and there's other shows on other than The Menu that people call in for. So there, you have some segment of your audience that's trained to do it right. And hopefully that brings some good questions. I've heard good questions and I think that you're graceful about it when people maybe aren't on track at guiding them back to the right topic. So you were talking about chefs and how both with The Menu and with Toasted Sister, you've been really lucky to get to interact with rising chefs and new restaurants. And so tell us about some of the Native American chefs and restaurants that are getting your attention lately.
Me Gym in Wisconsin, I think is really pretty cool. It's really low key. I've only heard of one other person who's visited and eaten there, and he said it was pretty good. So, you know, the Bryce Stevenson is the chef. I've had him on my show before, and before that, I never really knew who he was. And having to do all that research and then, you know, talk to him and have him on the show to talk about his new restaurant. And then, you know, he's up for a James Beard Award this year. So we'll see about that. But, you know, that has my attention. He's really cool to follow on social media now. And I think there are, you know, a couple of people who I really like to follow just because they are, you know, maybe they appreciate the same aesthetic I do. They, you know, are also artistic, kind of like I am, and see a value in, you know, art and, you know, maybe have the same kind of music. Music, you know, style that I like. And, you know, it's been really cool to see how they, you know, just kind of play around with all of this in the food work that they do. It might be really, really subtle, but, you know, sometimes all of these things just kind of blend together and you can see it there, whether it's in like the restaurant menu and the way it looks cool, or the decor in the restaurant. But, you know, so that up there, I really want to visit someday in the future. I also been interested in, let's see, who else?
Is there a restaurant that you haven't gotten to go to yet that you really want to?
Yes. It would be Mejum.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It would also be Native in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. She also came out of left field too. I didn't really know who she was. Siegfried is her last name. And she's also up for a James Beard Award this year. But her restaurant looks really cool, and it's located in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which, if you do a Google search, it's a really small town. It's really small, but it's cool that it looks like she has community support. It looks like her name and the restaurant is out there. So I think that's really cool for such a small town to be so inviting to, you know, a restaurant like that, that is focused on indigenous food and, you know, at that kind of, you know, kind of higher end scale that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit more about how cookbooks fit into the rise in popularity of indigenous cooking.
Yeah. So I think just last year there was 4 cookbooks that came out by Native chefs. And that really tells us that, you know, the cookbook industry people are paying attention to Native food now. And it kind of reflects what folks are interested in too. I think, you know, one tells something about the other, like the readers and what they want to tell industry people, like, oh, we need more of these kind of books, and people are responding with this and that. And, yeah. And so that just says that, you know, Native food and the chefs who are doing really awesome work out there are changing the narrative. And that's something that, we all just kind of were talking about a long time ago, changing the narrative and getting control over our own narrative, redefining things that come from our tribes and our communities and our grandmothers and ancestors. And it's really cool to see that like actually happening now.
Are there books that you find yourself cooking out of?
Not really. I never really cook out of a cookbook. You know, I have a whole shelf of cookbooks, and I got a library card because I just had, you know, too many cookbooks around, and I found out that they have cookbooks at the library. And new cookbooks too, not just like old Betty Crocker from like the 80s. So, you know, I go through cookbooks a lot and I go through food magazines a lot, but I never really cook from them. I just gather a lot of ideas. I gather so much just from the photo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, I cook myself. You know, I learned a whole lot about cooking just by reading all of this material and really wanting to bring all of that into my own kitchen, food sovereignty. And so I know how to cook, and but cooking from a cookbook's not, you know, something that I often do at all. And the native cookbooks, you know, sometimes they call for ingredients that you might have to, you know, go out and forage for sometimes. And that's just, I can't do that. I can't do that in my own personal life.
Well, from the photography then, or the storytelling, are there books that you have really caught your eye recently or in the past couple of years?
Yeah. So this one is actually called, it's a food memoir, but I included it into my wrap-up of Native cookbooks, but it is called Survival Food, Northwood Stories by a Menominee Cook by Thomas Picor Wiso. That one came out last year, a couple months ago. And before that, I hadn't read a book, you know, like a book in years, like more than 7 years. You know, my job, I read all day. I write all day. And it really wasn't something that I wanted to do at home after all day reading and writing. So, you know, this book came out and I thought, you know what, you know, let's get into it a little bit. And it just took me for an awesome ride. It really brought me back to the joy of reading. This author, Thomas Wiso, he's really good at describing things, describing food, and each of the chapters ends with a recipe and his own like instructions for the recipe. So that one was really, really good. And I thought the photography from Corn Dance by Loretta Barrett Oden, I thought that photography was pretty cool.
I'm so glad you mentioned survival food, because when I read about that on your website, it really caught my attention, because that's where my family is from, that part of Wisconsin. So I'm really interested in checking that book out.
Yeah.
So on the menu, you recently hosted Blue Adams talking about Native American chefs who were nominated for James Beard Awards. And she mentioned something that stood out to me in that segment. She said that when she was working in restaurants, platforms like Yelp didn't have a Native American food category, and that made it extra hard for those restaurants to get attention. And so what I was wondering if you had thoughts on is, what role do you think technology plays now, or maybe should or will play in the future, in supporting Native American foodways?
Well, I think so far it's done so much to kind of bring everybody to like a common ground, a common, you know, knowledge of traditional food. With social media, you know, we're all able to see each other, look at what each other is doing and learning from each other, when, you know, before there was actually like these physical conferences and gatherings that would happen that I could never go to because they're never in the Southwest. But of course, you know, with the pandemic, everybody moved their workshops to online. They started doing cooking videos and stuff online. And I learned a whole bunch from that, just to keep in touch with everybody and learn about all of this from everybody, is really just because of social media.
Mm-hmm. So I noticed you're putting on a festival coming up in April called Taste of Decolonization, right? Can you talk a little bit about the idea of decolonization as it applies to our palates and what we eat?
Yeah. So, okay, just the word decolonization, it's so long, it's not very sexy, and people use it a lot. So that was not like my first choice to name, you know, in this title for my food festival. But the fact that it's happening in Old Town Albuquerque, which is the spot where Albuquerque became a town when, you know, Spanish colonists came and just like built their houses and their church there. So that old part of Albuquerque is where it's taking place. And so that word just was fitting to take over that space that really hasn't been welcoming to Indigenous people. Yeah, take over that space and insert our own food. That it really just seemed fitting, and I couldn't find any other word besides decolonize, decolonization. But really, it makes a lot of a big statement to have this festival in Old Town. And the person I'm working with, Liz Gaylor, she is a Cherokee. And she's been kind of just working low key, and I didn't know she was even there as a owner of a little grocery store until she invited me to an event last year, and we just kind of, you know, were talking, and we eventually talked about, I wish there was a food festival or something like that where we could taste all kinds of native food, and nobody's gonna do it, and. Let's just do it. We have this space here. I own this grocery store, she said. So we've been working on that ever since. And we're going to combine it with poetry, Indigenous poetry about food. And it's going to start on Thursday, April 25th, with a dinner by Justin Pioshi. And beers by Bow and Arrow. Both of those are nominated for James Beard Awards. And after that, it's going to be, you know, sort of, it's going to be a festival. People are going to be able to come and try all kinds of foods from all kinds of native chefs that we've invited. And yeah, it should really be a fun time because we're working really hard on it. I didn't realize how much work goes into, you know, putting on an event, but it's all fun. You know, the to-do list is long, but everything on that to-do list is manageable. And it's fun. I've been having a lot of fun just doing the branding and the aesthetics of it all. So I'm happy.
That's great. I totally wish I could go. It sounds really fun and delicious.
Man.
Is there anything else that you want to tell us about with respect to what you're up to, what's happening in the Native American food space in the, you know, soon to happen future?
Mm-hmm. So this Native food movement and the trajectory of it, I think right now we're really highlighting Indigenous business. Like I said, the amount of restaurants that came out, that opened in just the last year really tells us that, you know, that there has been like a barrier there for a long time. There has been, you know, barriers, including like a community just not educated or maybe welcoming to an Indigenous restaurant. But with the amount of restaurants and other businesses that are opening, it's really exciting to see how it's going to really have an impact, how food and these food warriors are going to have an impact on the Native economy. I don't know what's next at this point because it seems like the business end of things are really what's hot right now. But whatever's going to come next is going to be really exciting.
Well, great. Seems like an apt assessment. We'll look forward to see how things progress and hopefully have you back to talk more another time. Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been listening to journalist, artist, and podcaster, Andy Murphy. Thank you for joining us today at Eat, Drink, Think. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to pick up your local edible magazine. You can find show notes for today's episode at ediblecommunities.com.